This is Bradcast producer Desi Doyen. We're off this week, so we're re-airing our special coverage of the four historic criminal indictments of Donald J. Trump. Today's episode, Fulton County, Georgia, D.A. Fonnie Willis's RICO indictment from August 16th, 2023.
Unless someone tells me differently, we are following our part, our normal practices. And so it doesn't matter your status. We have mugshots ready for you.
Mugshots are standing by in Fulton County.
Well, I don't know why I came here tonight.
Yeah, that's for you, Mr. Former President.
I got the feeling that something ain't right.
They work around the clock.
I'm so scared in case I fall off my chair.
They can't wait to take your
and
picture.
And I'm wondering how I'll get down the stairs.
You handsome devil.
Clowns to the left of me, jokers to the right. Here I am, stuck in the middle with you.
I am... From Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is the Bradcast, as heard on KPFK 90.7 FM in L.A., also in California in Red Bluff and Redding on KFOI, and Round Mountains, KKRN, in Oregon on the Central Coast on KYAQ, Cottage Grove's KSO, and Eugene's KEPW, Lanchester, Pennsylvania's W News, Maui, Hawaii's KAKU, in Columbus, Ohio on WGRN, Palinville, New York's WLPP, Rochester, New York's WRFZ, down in New Orleans on WHIV, out in Gallup, New Mexico on KNIZ, Concord, New Hampshire's WNHN, Fayetteville, Arkansas's KPSQ, in Seattle on KODX, Janesville, Wisconsin's WADR, in Minneapolis, St. Paul's AM 950, KTNF. We also stream coast to coast and around the globe every day on the internet on the Progressive Voices channel, Netroots Radio, Radio for Humans, NicoleSandler.com, Radio Free Brooklyn, No Lies Radio, Verdant Square Radio, Detour Talk, and most of your favorite podcast sites. Blanketing Planet Earth, I'm Brad Friedman, your friendly investigative blogger, journalist, troublemaker, muckraker, and all-around swell fellow, says me from bradblog.com. Thank you very much for joining us today for what we will call, Desi Doyen, special coverage of the latest, the last, the fourth indictment of Donald Trump of the summer. This hot indictment summer. disgraced, twice impeached, and now four-time criminally indicted former President Donald Trump and 18 co-defendants charged alongside him for various alleged, if failed, attempts to steal Georgia's 2020 presidential election from voters now have until Friday, August 25 at noon to turn themselves in voluntarily to the Fulton County Jail for booking. That, according to Fulton County District Attorney Fonnie Willis, late on Monday night after the grand jury indictment was unsealed. On Tuesday, the Fulton County Sheriff's Office announced, quote, based on guidance received from the District Attorney's Office and presiding judge, it is expected that all 19 defendants named in the indictment will be booked in the Rice Street Jail. The office added that, quote, defendants can turn themselves in at any time. The jail is open 24/7. Very convenient. Unlike Trump's three previous indictments, the sheriff's office noted the booking and arraignment processes in criminal cases operate separately in Fulton County. So they are two separate things. So Donald Trump will definitely go to jail in this case, if only to be booked, fingerprinted, and mugshot, at least if the county sheriff's earlier suggestion holds true. He said, quote, unless someone tells me differently, Fulton County Sheriff Pat Labatt recently told CNN, quote, we will be following the normal practices. It doesn't matter your status. We will have mugshots ready for you. That would be the first mugshot for Donald Trump if one is taken upon his arrest at the county jail, because he receives special treatment. The former president did not have mugshots taken in any of his last three criminal indictments over the past 4 months. I suspect you know by now that Fulton County prosecutors charged Trump and all 18 of his currently indicted co-conspirators with at least one count each of violating Georgia's racketeer-influenced and corrupt organizations, or RICO Act, this week. If found guilty of that one act alone, defendants will face a mandatory minimum 5-year sentence, though it's unclear if, as D.A. Willis has stated, that 5-year sentence includes jail time or if probation may also be included as part of that minimum sentence. But that is just one of the 41 charges included in the indictment, 13 of which Donald Trump is personally accused of. Other charges Trump and defendants are facing include solicitation of violation of oath by a public officer, conspiracy to commit impersonating a public officer, conspiracy to commit forgery in the first degree, conspiracy to commit false statements and writings, conspiracy to commit filing false documents, conspiracy to commit forgery in the first degree, filing false documents, and solicitation of violation of oath by a public officer. Moreover, as we reported in great detail on yesterday's broadcast, one of Trump's former attorneys, Sidney Powell, and several Georgia Republican and election officials are also charged in relation to the breach of, the tampering with, the copying of, and the distribution over the internet of sensitive voting system software in Coffee County, Georgia. Software that is used across the entire battleground state, as well as in jurisdictions in more than a dozen other states, and that will be used again in the critical 2024 presidential election next year. See bradblog.com for much more on that matter, which we helped break on this program over a year ago and have been reporting on ever since. Also charged on Monday night were Trump attorneys Rudy Giuliani, John Eastman, Jenna Ellis, and Ken Cheesebro, former Trump DOJ official Jeffrey Clark, the former GOP state chair in Georgia, a sitting GOP state senator in Georgia, and many others who took part in this alleged broad criminal enterprise, as alleged by Willis. The various indictees are accused of lying to high-ranking state officials to strong-arm or hoax them into flipping the results of that state that Joe Biden won over Donald Trump. They're charged with creating and distributing faked and forged electoral college documents, the appalling harassment of election workers in hopes of tricking them, hoaxing them into making false confessions of fraud, solicitation of Justice Department officials, the solicitation of then Vice President Mike Pence, the unlawful breach of election equipment, and acts of obstruction. In all, following the most recent indictment, his fourth in just over 4 months, and in theory the last one that we are at least expecting this summer, Donald John Trump is now personally facing 91 criminal felony charges across four separate jurisdictions at both the state and federal level, even as he is not only running for president of the United States in 2024, he continues to be the choice far and away, at least for now, among Republican primary voters for next year's nomination to be the party's standard bearer, according to all recent polling. Donald Trump, of course, denies any and all wrongdoing. He describes the latest indictment, just like all of the others, as a witch hunt against him. And he claims that he will soon reveal, quote, irrefutable evidence that the 2020 election was stolen from him, disproving the mountain of actual evidence provided by prosecutors from Special Counsel Jack Smith in D.C. to Fannie Willis in Georgia that he and his team repeatedly attempted but failed to steal the election himself. On Wednesday afternoon, according to CNN, just before airtime, D.A. Willis has requested that the judge in the Georgia case set a trial date of March 4, 2024. For those keeping track of such things at home, that would be the day before Super Tuesday next year when nearly 15 states will hold their presidential primaries. Okay, then, does that sound like fun to you, Desi Doyen?
Not really.
Oh, okay. Well, you got the trial, you got Super Tuesday.
Sounds a little busy.
Should be an easy week. After covering the details of the latest indictment on yesterday's show, we will get to some analysis today, both legal and political, from a couple of regular guests on this program. Joining us once again today is former attorney, former Republican, and current Daily Kos legal contributor, where he is known simply as Keith DB. That would be Keith Barber, who joins us from a far-right enclave in the great state of Florida. Keith Barber, welcome back. And by the way, is it funny or fawny?
I think it's fawny.
I think you might be right, but I'm sticking with fawny for the moment. Yeah. Also joining us, as is frequently the case for our special coverage panel programs, is the much beloved longtime blogger known as simply Digby at her Hullabaloo blog. She is the award-winning Salon columnist Heather Digby Parton. Oh, Heather, welcome back to the broadcast. And is it Cheesebro or Chesbro?
Well, I've heard different things, but yeah. I think we're going with Cheesebro, aren't we? I mean, isn't that what we should go with?
That's what I prefer.
Okay.
Cheesebro sounds a lot more fun.
Cheesebro. All right.
Exactly.
It's Cheesebro, and I actually think that's right. And for now, it's funny, and I actually think that's wrong. Anyway, Heather, let me start with your top-line reactions here to this sprawling 97-page indictment that we have been arguing, by the way, for some time, was likely to be the broadest of all of the indictments to come down, because unlike Jack Smith's federal indictment on Trump's attempted election theft 2 weeks ago, that was narrowly tailored to sort of focus only on Trump, get him to trial as soon as possible before next year's election and before Trump might be able to pardon himself if he becomes president again. Fannie Willis, of course, is under no such constraints at the state level, where Trump cannot pardon himself even if he wins next year and becomes president again. So I'm wondering, just for the moment, your top line thoughts on these broad new charges.
Well, I mean, I think I'm vastly relieved that some case actually did pull this entire story together. You know, I mean, we didn't really know what was going to happen on the federal level. And I understand the thinking that went into, you know, producing this narrow indictment with just Trump and then these unindicted co-conspirator lawyers. And I guess there's one operative that's in the list. Mm-hmm. I get the reasoning behind that, but I was really glad to see that she did do this, you know, this sprawling story, which mm-hmm. really does encompass the entire thing, at least to the extent that we know about it. And it mirrors in many ways what we saw in the January 6th committee public hearing, mm-hmm. which sort of brought all these things together. And so seeing this, that story go before a jury, I think is really important. And, you know, I don't care at all if it happens before the election or after. It just, this has to be done. And I'm glad to see that she did it.
And as someone who's been following really all of this for very closely over the past 2.5 years or so, is there anything that you learned from this indictment that you did not already know about this crime spree?
Absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, we knew about the phone calls to the various, you know, Republican officials in the swing states that were run by Republicans. And we knew that was that plot was unfolding. What's interesting about all that is that I don't think, at least I didn't know anything about this Coffee County. I mean, I knew what had happened there, but I think was going on the assumption that these were just Trump people who were trying to help out. Mm-hmm. You know, I did not realize that Sidney Powell had actually hired this, you know, so-called law firm to come and help them. Mm-hmm. And more than that, I didn't realize that they were intent upon sharing this information that they got from the voting machine
yep.
with states around the country. So, I mean, that's kind of mind blowing. I mean, that's the kind of conspiracy you can really sink your teeth into, right? Which, I mean, that is really serious.
It very serious. And of course, we helped break that story on this show last year. And we've been trying to get people to pay attention because it was actually hatched, never mind Sidney Powell, this was actually hatched in the Oval Office at that crazy December 18, 2020 meeting.
Yep.
This was sort of plan B when they decided against seizing all the voting machines across the country. So this is a multi-state conspiracy. It's not just Georgia, which is leading me to wonder when either Jack Smith or the Department of Justice is going to get into this, because this happened in a bunch of states. Keith, your sort of top line response to the Fani Willis indictment this week, and anything that surprised you or that you learned from the indictment?
The power of RICO again. Mm. One of the names that I guess surprised me a little bit to see on there was Jeff Clark.
Mm.
Jeff Clark didn't do anything in Georgia. He never went to Georgia. I don't know if in his life he's ever been to Georgia. But here he appears mm-hmm. on this indictment because in Washington, D.C., he drafted a letter that he then tried to get his superiors to write that said that falsely said that they had found election fraud in Georgia. The letter was specific to Georgia. And so Fani Willis gets him for, you know, attempting to submit, you know, a false document or record. And, you know, somebody that I consider to be one of the worst actors in this whole story, because I kind of just viewed that as beyond the pale to try and sit down with your bosses and make them sign a lie and use their boss to threaten to fire them mm-hmm. if they don't do it.
Yeah.
As kind of just one of those big wow things in this, and she's got him now on you know, the RICO charge and that charge. So, you know, the power of RICO.
And it's because of RICO. You were on the show a week or so ago discussing, explaining to us what the difference is between a RICO case and just a sort of a regular conspiracy case, where they can actually bring in everyone who is involved in the enterprise. And because Georgia's case, Georgia's RICO law is so broad, it can actually reach out to crimes that were done in other states in furtherance of the same crime. Is that how Clark sort of gets pulled into all of this?
Yeah, and it was, you know, like I said, Clark never went to Georgia. We don't know that he talked to anybody in Georgia. That's certainly not alleged.
Mm-hmm.
But he was part of the same criminal enterprise that aimed to overturn Georgia's fair election results.
Mm-hmm. I wasn't surprised so much as struck by the sheer amount of effort that went into this enterprise that we've been all following, you know, all along. But seeing it in one place was kind of remarkable to read the story through. And also, there was this one act that is detailed as part of the RICO charge that I sort of raised an eyebrow at. It describes emails from between the far-right Trump attorneys John Eastman and Ken Cheesebro discussing on December 23 their plan for using the Electoral Count Act to have Mike Pence, Vice President Mike Pence, which we knew about, quote, or Grassley, that would be President Pro Tem of the Senate at the time, Iowa's Republican Senator Chuck Grassley, you know, basically abused the Electoral Count Act on January 6th to toss out the legitimate electoral electoral college votes. Were they already planning in December of 2020 to replace Mike Pence somehow as president of the Senate with Chuck Grassley?
Well, it sure sounds like it was some kind of a plan B, like maybe if Pence refused to even appear that day or something, that they could replace him with Grassley or some, you know, something like that. I mean, that's been curious to me for a while, mm-hmm. what they had in mind with that Grassley part of it. And Grassley was all in, by the way. Mm-hmm. I mean, let's not think that he was, you know, he didn't understand what he was doing. He was all in on this, as were, I mean, you know, as we look at this vast conspiracy here, and it truly is vast, and this indictment certainly lays it out very clearly,
mm-hmm.
how it was multi-state and it was at multiple levels of different government officials throughout the country in these swing states. You know, there's one group that is not it hasn't come up anywhere in anything, including the January 6th committee, and that is the members of Congress who were involved in this. And
right.
there were a whole bunch of them, Chuck Grassley being one of them. I mean, there was Mike Lee. There was, and we know all the people in the House. Trump even referenced them when he was talking to the acting attorney general at the time, Jeff Rosen, when he said, you know, I just need you to go out and say that there's been fraud and the Republican leave the rest of it to the Republican congressman and me. So, I mean, they were obviously conspiring, which I find really interesting that there's apparently they're just untouchable from what you get. You know, none of the investigations have actually touched them, which is kind of a shame because there were some that were very, very closely involved. This guy, you know, Scott Perry, for instance, that's one of the people that Mark Meadows brought into the whole thing. Mark Meadows is another story here. So I find that very, I continue to find that very interesting and kind of disturbing.
And I'm honest. And I promise we will get to Mark Meadows in a second, because I know you wrote about him today. But Keith, Chuck Grassley, you could arguably say that he didn't deal with Georgia at all directly, even though we have RICO here that could bring him in. But what about Lindsey Graham? He actually made calls to the Secretary of State and said, can we throw out votes in the most Democratic counties in the state?
And he wasn't charged, and there's no hint that he's even an unindicted co-conspirator. But I think we need to remember about Grassley was, I believe it was the day on January 5th, the day before, he made some sort of strange statement. Mm-hmm. And maybe it was even a tweet, but he basically said that he expected to be acting as president of the Senate on the 6th.
Right.
Because he didn't think Pence was going to be there.
Right. So it seems like they were talking about this, that there was some plan.
So, you know, and then, you know, Pence basically said, well, I am. And Grassley backed off. And but it created a bit of a tempest for a short period of time when a lot of other things were obviously going on. You know, that it has been one of those unresolved little mysteries about this, that statement. And it remains so. She could have charged him, I suppose, but she didn't.
She didn't.
I doubt there was enough evidence.
Well, we'll see.
I just add something on that? I mean, the Grassley thing?
Yeah.
One of the things that had occurred to me was, you know, we remember that when the they stormed the Capitol and they were trying, you know, they were chasing Mike Pence through the halls saying, hang Mike Pence.
You mean that tourist event.
Right, the tourist visit, where they're having their picnics and stuff.
Yeah,
it was really nice. And so he was taken down to the garage where he stayed, refused to get in the car, you remember, and he said, I won't, you know, I trust you, he said to his own Secret Service detail. He said, I don't know who these guys are, and there was talk back in the White House of, you know, his national security advisor, Keith Kellogg, who, by the way, has turned on him and is now a full-blown Trumper. But aside from that, he said to the head of the Secret Service or the liaison with the Secret Service there, he said, you know, well, we're afraid that if we let him get in that car, that you're not going to bring him back. And they had word that the Secret Service, that they were a little concerned about the Secret Service, you remember, that, you know, Mike Pence was worried about it. It just occurred to me when I was looking at this Grassley thing a while back, and I was thinking, did they think that maybe they would take Mike Pence out of there? That there would be some, you know, that, I don't know, that they kind of knew that there might be some kind of commotion? And that Mike Pence would be taken away, and then they would have to replace him with the, you know, pro tem, like Chuck Grassley, and that would be the way that it was. I mean, you really have to wonder, you know, how. I mean, this was a strange moment and a strange plan B to have Grassley sort of waiting, and there was that whole little contretemps with Pence down in the garage. So anyway, just thought I'd throw that out there. It was one of those things that's kind of been rattling around in my head for a while.
No, absolutely. And it would, let me just make this, give you this thought that, you know, we know the Secret Service was sort of in the tank for Donald Trump. It would have been very easy to put together a scheme that says, all right, we'll cause a disturbance. We'll hustle the vice president out for his safety. We will bring him away. And then Chuck Grassley, who has already agreed to go along with this scheme, he'll take over as president. president of the Senate because he's president pro tem, and we send everything back to the states or whatever it is they were planning to do, it sure sounds like there's unexplored criming going on there. Keith, I cut you off. Keith, go ahead.
Yeah, way back when, I'm trying to find it to even remember when it was, but I wrote an article about it entitled, The Plot to Kidnap the Vice President of the United States.
Yeah, yeah.
I got that direct about it.
Yeah.
And I mean, it's pretty chilling. You had the vice president sitting there and saying to a Secret Service detail, I'm not getting in that car.
Yep. And that's the point that I keep, I've come back. I know Heather and I have talked about this a lot of times. That was the point, perhaps the only point that I'm willing to give Mike Pence a Profile in Courage award for. But that moment was critical. Had he gotten into that car, I think we would be living and was taken away and Grassley took over in the Senate. I think we might be living in a very different world today. Let me move on to Mark Meadows. And I know, Heather, you wrote about it. I have a question for you about your piece at Salon today. But Keith, if you can tell me, Meadows took a very quick action here on the day after the indictment this week to file a motion to remove the Georgia Georgia indictment from state to federal court. What is his hope there? What would such a change in venue actually get him? And what are his odds of success as you see it in that motion?
Well, it's got a reasonable chance. He is arguing that he was acting as a federal official, and the law provides for removal for federal officers acting within their, the capacity of their job, really in order to prevent state officials from trying to punish federal officials from doing their job. And so it's got a credible chance. I'm sure that Fani Willis will have arguments against it, it's at risk. I think that he is hoping to complicate the case and to delay it, to get it into a federal court where there will at least be a chance that the judge is a Trump appointee and therefore might be more favorable to him, and to get it in a venue where he is more likely to get a favorable jury.
And of course, if it's a if that goes his way, if it becomes a federal trial, would he then be charged under federal law or Georgia state law? In other words, if Donald Trump was then able to win the presidential election next year, would he be able to pardon Mark Meadows?
No, he would not.
Because it would still be state charges.
It would act as a state conviction still while tried in a federal court. It would be prosecuted still under the state laws that Fani Willis has charged. And in fact, Fani Willis's office would still be the prosecutors for the case and not federal prosecutors from the Department of Justice.
Well, it is interesting that in the Georgia case, Meadows is charged, like all of the 19 of the co-conspirators, under the RICO charge number one, but he's only charged under one other act, whereas most of the folks, Keith, you pointed out, have about seven charges each on average. Heather, you have an article up today at Salon that was written. I saw the headline and I thought, wait, did she write this after the Georgia indictment in which Meadows was charged on these two counts? But in fact, you're arguing that he may have flipped, at least in the federal case. Can you explain your theory there in that piece at Salon?
Well, I don't know. And I don't think anybody knows. It's been one of the great mysteries of this whole thing. I should preface this by saying Mark Meadows did one smart thing in his life. He's not the smartest guy, but he hired a lawyer by the name of George Terwilliger, who was a very highly respected lawyer in Washington, D.C. He was a member of the Bush administration, and I think he travels in the same circles as Bill Barr. He's in that kind of a group.
Right.
Very hardcore conservative lawyer, but he has protected Mark Meadows throughout this entire thing very, very wisely. And Mark Meadows has actually done what he told him to do. And he shut his pie hole and did not go out and start talking on TV about all this. And so it's been very curious what he did. We know that he testified before the federal grand jury. And it's very weird that he didn't show up in that indictment of Donald Trump, because he was intimately involved in all this stuff. We also know that he was, I mean, we know he was intimately involved. He was calling people. Like I said earlier, he brought in this guy, Scott Perry, who was a, you know, who was a big part of the whole scheme with the Department of Justice. He was very much, he was passing around to the Department of Justice, telling them to investigate things like the weird Italian satellite conspiracy theory.
That was Scott, I mean, he was Scott Perry, the Republican,
Republican congressman
from Pennsylvania.
Yeah, exactly. So, he, you know, he was earlier when he had, when the January 6th committee first, you know, subpoenaed him, he cooperated and he gave them a bunch of information. And then his book came out and Trump got angry at him because he talked about how he was disheveled and wearing a T-shirt when he had COVID, you know, Meadows shut down. Now, I suspect he shut down because of his lawyer, Terwilliger, who told him, okay, that's it, you're not doing that. And when it went to the Department of Justice, they filed a contempt charge against him for failing to, you know, fulfill a subpoena. The Congress did, the committee did. And the DOJ didn't charge him. They did charge Bannon, Steve Bannon, and they charged Peter Navarro, but they didn't charge him, and they didn't charge Dan Scavino. So maybe that came under some executive privilege thing. In any case, I'm just saying it's weird. He went to Georgia. He was subpoenaed down there. He testified before the grand jury, the original special grand jury, and he took the Fifth, apparently. Now, we know why he took the Fifth, because you can see by this indictment that they had him, you know, they indicted him on this crime of talking on the Raffensperger call. Apparently, he said some things on that call. I can't remember the specific words. I wrote it in there. In fact, the judge that was handling the grand jury actually used these words to say that he was, I don't know, eagerly and enthusiastically or something like that, offering information on that call. So, you know, he got indicted for that. And then, of course, in the grand scheme of this big conspiracy, they talk a lot about Meadows being involved. He was in meetings with Trump, with the Pennsylvania, you know, delegation and all this other stuff. What we don't know is what in the world is going on with Mark Meadows. Why is he being treated with kid gloves when we know for a fact that he was involved in absolutely everything there? It's documented. We know it. And other people who were just sort of peripherally and tangentially involved have been either named as unindicted co-conspirators or have been, you know, actually indicted. And so it's very, very strange. I don't know why. I don't know if he flipped. I didn't write the headline, by the way. I didn't do that. But it's very curious.
It sure looks like he's flipped on Trump. That's in the headline.
That's not my headline.
I understand. That's Salon's headline. But you asked the question: is it possible that he has that he has flipped? And let me before I got to get to a break here. So very quickly, Keith Barber, is it possible that Mark Meadows could flip in? And I guess, Heather, your argument is that he's flipped in the federal case, if not in the Georgia case.
Cooperated in some way.
Is it possible, Keith, that he could be cooperating at the federal level, but not cooperating at the state level where he was charged in the Fani Willis case?
It's possible. Well, that is awfully weird. Why would you spill your beans to Jack Smith, but then plead the Fifth down in Atlanta? You know, there is all sorts of speculation on Twitter, I guess I should call it X, that Meadows has flipped, that he's, you know, he's been flipped for a long time. I just tend to be skeptical of that sort of thing until there's real evidence of it. It's like Heather said, he's done what a subject or target to investigation should do, and that is shut up. Any targets of investigations not named Donald Trump generally understand that.
Well, it does.
You know,
yeah, go ahead.
All we can do is we're trying to infer from his silence that maybe he's cooperating. The silence and the fact that he hasn't been,
right,
you know, charged by Jack Smith. But then again, only Trump has been charged.
Well,
by
but
Jack
he
Smith.
But he also wasn't named as an unindicted co-conspirator, as six other people were in that case. And as you would think, since he was neck deep in so much of this stuff at the federal level in a bunch of states, that he would have been at least named as an unindicted co-conspirator, which does sort of lean in the favor of the argument that Digby is suggesting there, at least. Listen, guys, I got to take a quick break, and I want to come back and talk about Trump's claims at exoneration and some more political stuff, including the GOP, the first GOP debate, which is, oh, Desi's already frowning at this, which is next week.
Yeah.
And whether Donald Trump can actually, with all of this baggage, still end up being the Republican nominee for president of the United States. All of that is straight ahead right here on our special coverage today on the broadcast with Keith Barber and Heather Digby Parton. I'm Brad Friedman. Don't touch that dial.
What the public hears on the public airwaves matters. At the broadcast, we do our best to bring you accurate news and analysis on the issues that actually matter, and we do it all independently without corporate or political influence. But we can't do it without you, now more than ever. Please help us stay on your public airwaves by going to bradblog.com/donate to help keep us going. That's bradblog.com/donate. And thanks.
Hey, this is Brad. You're listening to an encore presentation of the Bradcast.
I am an innocent man. I am an innocent man.
Uh-huh.
Oh, yes, I am.
Yeah. Good luck with that. Welcome back to the Bradcast. Brad Friedman from bradblog.com. Special coverage of the latest indictment of Donald Trump. 97 pages, 41 charges overall, 19 co-conspirators, RICO charges, 13 of those charges against Donald Trump himself, with Salon's Heather Digby Parton, Daily Kos's Keith Barber. As Trump supporters woke up on Tuesday morning, following the late night indictment, the announcement of the indictment of Trump on Monday in Georgia, the first thing that they may have seen was an early morning post by Trump at his social media website reading, quote, "a large, complex, detailed, but irrefutable report," in all caps for some reason, I don't know, "on the presidential election fraud, which took place in Georgia, is almost complete and will be presented by me at a major news conference at 11 a.m. on Monday of next week in Bedminster, New Jersey. Based on the results of this conclusive," all caps, "report, all charges will be dropped, should be dropped against me and others. There will be a complete exoneration. They never went after those that rigged the election," he argues. "They only went after those that fought to find the riggers." Okay. Heather Digby Parton, what do you expect from this irrefutable report? And am I wrong for even raising attention to it over our public airwaves today?
No, I think it's actually quite smart of you to raise it, and I think it's important that you raise it, and here's why.
Mm-hmm.
So what the reaction that I'm seeing is Republicans, you know, absolutely hanging their heads and going, oh my God, here we go again with the, you know, the 2020 election and the big lie. Mm-hmm. They wanted him to shut up about it, and they told him after the 2022 election that he shouldn't talk about it anymore. People didn't like it. People were sick of it. And I suppose it was inevitable, considering these cases that have come up, you know, these indictments that are all about the 2020 election. But nonetheless, they didn't want him out here doing that stuff, you know, trying to, you know, holding up charts and doing all that stupid stuff again. Uh-huh. So, yeah, I think it's important. I think everyone should take a look at that. I think it's really important that everybody see that, especially Republicans. I hope they tune in and watch it with, you know, with rapt focus, because it's important that this get out there. We need to be talking about the 2020 election again.
I'm sure it will not be easily debunked material either.
No,
Keith,
of course not.
Keith Barber, you mentioned via email that I think when this came out on Tuesday, that his post contains his usual nonsense about it was rigged, his rantings, and a claim that next week he's going to refute the irrefutable report proving Georgia's, or will release an irrefutable report proving that Georgia's election was defrauded. And then you say this could maybe bite him. Setting aside the political matter that I think Heather was referring to there, I think you're referring to legally. How could this bite him on Monday legally?
Well, let's face it. This thing isn't going to contain anything new, nothing. It's going to be just a rehashing of the old garbage. You know, expect to see the video again of the suitcases being rolled out with ballots. Mm-hmm. You know, it'll be the same old stuff again. You know, Trump was the head of a criminal enterprise mm-hmm. to overturn the election results in Georgia. And according to the allegations in the indictment, that criminal enterprise continued long after Biden was sworn into office. You know, there are allegations that go into mid-2021 and even 2022 associated with this. So it was obvious that the criminal enterprise described by Fani Willis was going on then. Fani Willis gets to argue now that the criminal enterprise is still ongoing. Mm. They're still doing it. Mm-hmm. It hasn't disbanded. It hasn't dissolved. It's the criminal enterprise is running to this day. That Trump, you know, put up these people to come up with this false report, just as he put up, you know, other proxies to lie for him in Georgia on these matters. And, you know, one of these strong provisions in RICO, I keep talking about how powerful that statute is that it has powerful forfeiture provisions that are designed to pre-trial take away from a criminal enterprise its continued ability to function.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah, to seize ill-gotten gains, which would make it very hard for him to defend himself if he has to turn over, I guess, funds that he raised under these false claims of
you know,
fraud.
I'm not sure what it would be that Ms. Willis could go after, but I'm hoping she has some ideas. But she gets to say that it's not over. The criminal enterprise hasn't dissolved, and this court should do something to make sure that it can no longer function.
Now, Keith, I have a quick question for you. As I understand it, and please correct me if I'm wrong, even if Trump could prove his nonsense about the 2020 election, doesn't that mean that, though, you still are not allowed to try to overthrow the government and seize the presidency, that's still against the law, regardless of how right you believe you are?
Yes, that's true. A genuine belief, and maybe even we'll stipulate for the purposes of discussion,
this hypothetical,
a correct belief that there were problems with the election, that they were significant, does not mean that you can commit forgery. Mm-hmm. For example, and forge Electoral College certificates. It does not mean that you can threaten a Secretary of State with criminal prosecution unless he finds for you the exact number of votes that you need.
Solicit an officer, an official to violate their oath of office, stuff like that is still illegal?
Yeah, you can't demand that your subordinates sign a letter that's a lie.
I think it was Josh Marshall at Talking Points Memo today who said, even if you think the bank owes you money, you are not allowed to go and stick up the bank. to get it. Heather, I want to hit a couple more points here on the political side of this very quickly in the few minutes that we have. Kind of a screeching turn here, but Heather, what should we expect from the first GOP primary debate? The very first one will be on Wednesday, August 23, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, a critical battleground state. What should we expect from that debate? And I guess the maybe interesting question of whether Donald Trump will show up for it or not.
Well, I think that's actually a big question. I mean, if he shows up, it's a different debate because, of course, you know, everything's all about him. And it will be potentially about him if somebody like, you know, somebody like Chris Christie will obviously go after him. That's his whole brand in this.
It should be about him, shouldn't it?
He's the front runner, right? And if he doesn't show up, you'd think they would all go after him. But look at how they've reacted to everything. They all act like, you know, they walk around on eggshells about Trump. So I wouldn't, you know, if he's not there, I don't think they'll all go after him. Maybe they'll make some tepid little remark. They'll ask Mike Pence about the January 6th or the mm-hmm. case in Georgia, which, by the way, today he did say the election was not stolen in Georgia. Big of him. So, you know, they'll ask him questions like that. But I think what's going to happen, I mean, what I suspect is important here is that it will be the first sign of two things. One, who are going to be the first ones to drop out? We'll start to see that there'll be, you know, some of these people, we're not going to see them again. And the second thing that will be everybody's watching, of course, is can DeSantis say anything to try and rescue himself? Because I think this may be his last hurrah. He's on a full Scott Walker, you know, odyssey one debate, or maybe it was two during the 2016 campaign. And he had been the great white bread hope like DeSantis has been. Right. And none of that's working out for him. So that's what I'll be looking for anyway.
Well, and by the way, when I say it should be about Donald Trump is making the 2024 race about Donald Trump. So it seems to me that that's the only issue that Republicans are running on at this point that they have to run on, or at least that he is letting them run on at this point.
I totally agree. I mean, it should be about him. It is about him. He's running as an incumbent, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, that's pretty much so. Let's talk about him. I mean, and they don't really have anything else to say. Let's face it. There's no real agenda.
Well, they're about
this is what it is.
They're about to nominate someone with 91 criminal charges against them. It seems like a topic of note. Keith Barber, does Donald Trump have anything to actually gain by participating in the debate next week?
I don't think he does, and if I was his attorney, I would be doing everything in my power to keep him out of that debate.
Mm.
You do not want him in a live event like that where he is being questioned, and particularly being questioned sometimes hostily by, you know, his opponents, answering questions and saying things.
Mm-hmm.
Christie's smart enough to try and goad him into saying something stupid, to attacking witnesses in the court and the judge. And Trump wants to do that anyway. And he does what he wants to do, and that's not what his attorney will want him to do.
You just convinced me that he's going to show up. He's going to do it. I'm sure now that he's going to be there.
Because it's the most wrong
thing to do.
Exactly.
By the way, there's an RNC requirement in theory that all the candidates must sign a pledge to support the party's eventual nominee if they want to participate in this debate. I think Trump has said who will and who won't sign that agreement. I mean, will Chris Christie really sign that agreement? I will support the nominee even if it's Donald Trump. Will he sign that in order to show up on the debate?
Well, he said that he wouldn't, but then recently I think I heard him say that he would sign it because, you know, it's not worth the paper it's written on because Donald Trump is not going to follow it anyway. So it is the whole thing is ridiculous. So, I suspect it's just, you know, it's a joke.
All right. Let me go around the table in just a few minutes that we have here, because this has been coming up more and more In my brain, I've sort of hinted at it a little bit. It's still sort of just a spidey sense, although I am hearing since the Georgia indictment, I am hearing from more listeners via email about this. The question of whether Donald Trump will actually end up being the nominee. I cannot help but think that this is not going to work out, that he may not end up being the nominee. Either the GOP gets wise to the idea that nominating a guy who has been indicted four times on 91 criminal charges might not be the smartest thing to win the presidency, or that, you know, Trump will, when all else appears to be failing, start begging for a plea deal to keep himself out of prison in exchange for not running for public office anymore. It feels to me like somehow this just can't continue. And maybe I'm just too optimistic. But you know what? I was also optimistic when everybody said it wasn't going to happen, that, yes, Donald Trump was going to finally face accountability with indictments a long time ago. I'm not predicting it, but I have this feeling he is not actually going to be the nominee, or at least, yeah, on the ticket when we get to November 2024. Let me get your thoughts. Am I wrong about that? Am I overly optimistic? Keith, your thoughts?
You're wrong.
Okay. Fair enough.
I will sum it up.
Mark this down. We will play it next year, Desi Doyen, okay, if need be. All right, go ahead.
Donald Trump has already had a jury find that he raped a woman. A judge has already ruled not once but twice that is what the jury decided. And his supporters do not care. If his supporters do not care that a jury has found that he raped a woman, they won't care about anything, none of this. And in the days when you thought that maybe GOP leadership could derail a candidacy, and maybe they could back in different days, that's not true anymore. This is in the hands of the radical cult MAGA segment, and nothing will deter them. And if that rape story doesn't tell you that, then nothing will.
And even if he goes begging these prosecutors to let him off the hook once it looks like he's really going to go to prison and have to muss up his hair, that he's got to get out of this some way or another. The only thing that he has to offer right now is essentially saying, okay, I won't run for president if you don't make me go to jail.
He's going to pull that deal off with three different prosecutors in three different jurisdictions. And even if Jack Smith bought it, and I don't think that he would, are you going to get Bragg and Willis to do that too? I just don't see that sort of thing happening.
Correction, that's three different prosecutors in four different jurisdictions. Heather, Heather Digby Parton, would you also like to tell me that I am wrong? And we're going to,
yes,
again,
I would.
We are recording this for the record.
You
go
are
ahead.
So wrong.
Uh-huh.
You
okay.
are so wrong.
Okay.
Okay, write it down, Desi.
Okay, okay, got it.
He is wrong. Okay. Yeah, okay, good.
All right.
Because there is, first of all, you're saying that Donald Trump's going to get up in front of a judge and admit that he committed a crime, and that he did all this, and that everything he's been saying for the last 2 years has been wrong, and that he is guilty, and that he's going to accept this plea deal. It's just completely, I think he would rather, honestly, I think he'd rather go to jail than ever admit it. And furthermore, the thing that he thinks is going to save him is becoming president again. Now, I realize that the state, the indictments that he's facing in Georgia, I think he's just thinking, I'll wing that too. I'll figure out a way. I'll get some new Georgia, new guy in the governor's mansion, and we'll make it so they can pardon me. I mean, he just assumes that his way out of this is to win the election and then basically make all this stuff go away. So I don't think there's a chance in hell that he will thinks he's facing going to jail. I don't think he believes he will ever go to jail.
And I take it that means you also agree with Keith that the voters are not going to get wise to this. Remember, we're still, months away from the actual primary voters turning out. They're not going to be looking at this and go, you know what? Do we really want to nominate a guy who's facing 91 charges as our standard bearer? You don't think that's going to have any effect on the Republican voters next year?
it might have an effect on some Republican voters, but not enough to deny him the nomination. I mean, there may be some who are going, hey, you know, do we really want this? But there just aren't enough of them. Most of the party are MAGA now, and they are going to vote for him. And if he isn't the nominee, if somehow or another someone else becomes the nominee and Donald Trump is still standing, they're not going to vote at all, because it's all about him for these people. As long as he's on the stage, it's about him. So, as we were saying earlier, so I just don't see any possibility that he's not going to be the guy, unless, you know, obviously something happens to him physically, if he
like
gets
nature
sick or,
takes its course, you know, or something.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. That sort of thing. If that happened, then obviously that things would be different. But then think about it. Who are they going to pick? Look at this group.
That's the last thing I want to ask you. Even if Glenn Youngkin tomorrow announces he's getting in the race.
Why does everybody think this guy is like some kind of great? He's just so exciting that the minute he gets in, everything changes.
I'm not arguing this. I am just asking questions. So that would make no difference to you at all if Glenn Youngkin got in.
He's Scott Walker part two. Remember the charisma of Scott Walker. Keith, no, there's nobody out there.
Keith, you want to ring in? Glenn Youngkin makes no difference, right?
I concur with Heather. It's not about any of the others.
And Desi, before we get out, Desi, you tell me I'm wrong every day, so that's nothing new.
Well,
but
on this particular
on
one, yeah. I really honestly don't know, but I think the point about the fact that Republican primary voters do not care, they're the ones that decide the Republican nominee in the Republican primary. I think we have to remember that this conspiracy to steal the 2020 election was a Republican Party-wide conspiracy. It involved hundreds of Republican officials across the United States, including the chair of the Republican National Committee, sitting state lawmakers, sitting members of Senate and the House, and the GOP candidates for 2024 have not condemned this indictment
part,
or the actions that he's taken. For the most part, Republican MAGA cult members don't care. So I think we have to keep that in mind whenever we approach any of this, that the Republican Party is in on the entire
thing.
They're
all in. All right. We got to get all out. My thanks to Heather Digby Parton, of course, of Salon and digbysblog.net. You can find her on the website formerly known as Twitter at Digby56. You can find Keith Barber, who is known as KeithDB, over at dailycoast.com. You can find him also on that X Twitter website. At KeithDB80. Great having both of you as ever on the broadcast. I suspect we'll be talking to both of you very soon, whether you like it or not. My thanks as well to Desi Doyen, our producer, and to all of you for spending a portion of your day or night with us. If you missed any portion of today's program, you can download it anytime for free at bradblog.com. There is no paywall there. That is thanks to those of you who stopped by bradblog.com/donate to help us stay on your public airwaves. Drop me email if you like. I am bradcast@bradblog.com, and you'll find me on the Facebooks, Mastodons, and site formerly known as Twitter at TheBradBlog. We will see you there. Until we see you here next time, I'm Brad Friedman. Good luck, world. You're listening to the Bradcast. We are 100% listener supported, thanks to listeners like you who stop by bradblog.com/donate.